Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety.
This is the Warrior Next Door podcast, where we share oral histories from veterans whose stories provide an intimate look at world history and how much it still affects us today. All the veterans featured were interviewed by your co-host while serving as volunteers for the Library of Congress. Our interviews, over 200 in total, were conducted with veterans who live in our cities, our neighborhoods, and often right next door to us. You can listen to the full-length, unedited interviews from each veteran we feature on our YouTube and Facebook pages. Come join us. Hey, welcome back, Warrior Next Door listeners. You know, there's no bad day when Ryan and I get a chance to share some of the stories we've heard with our audience. And for those who have listened to the mini-series, or watched, I should say, the mini-series, Masters of the Air, which is based off the book by Donald Miller, who we just had on our podcast recently, you may be saddened by the fact that Episode 9 is over. No more Masters of the Air. And you may have been a little surprised that there was a follow-on, like a bonus track called The Bloody Hundredth, which was narrated by Tom Hanks. And you probably would have seen someone from The Bloody Hundredth that was featured prominently in that series or in that special episode. And his name was John Lucky Luckadoo. He's 102 years old and still kicking. And we had a chance to meet with Lucky before we even knew that there would be additional content released on Apple TV, which would feature him and others from the 100th Bomb Group. And believe me, there's not too many of those gentlemen left. So sit back, strap in, and just enjoy the fact that we're going to have about three or four episodes of some amazing content coming up featuring John Luckadoo and the author of his biography, Kevin Maurer, who wrote the book Damn Lucky. You're going to hear a lot more about that and more, so let's jump right in. Just so you know, Kevin, we're recording right now. I generally like to record right from the start because a lot of the early banter ends up being about as good. Sometimes you can capture little things as you do when you go into the actual interview part. But I had a chance to look at the books that you've written, and you've written some amazing books. Most of them seem to be centered around more of the modern warfighters. Is this your first attempt at writing a book on someone from World War II?
No, it's my second, but it's my best one.
All right. And how did you and Lucky, how did the two of you meet? And then what was your path toward writing a book together?
Lucky gave an interview, a Q&A interview with the Military Times, where he laid out, it was question and answer. So I read this Q&A and it, Lucky tells bits of his story, and it was such a really good story that I started digging around looking for what's the book that this prompted this Q&A, and there was no book. So then I spent a lot of time tracking Lucky down, and I called him out of the blue and said, "Hey, where's your book?" And he said, "I don't have one yet." And I said about 60 days of begging him to let me write this book, and then he decided he was going to give me that honor, and so that's how it happened.
It's a fantastic book. Lucky, how do you think it turned out? Are you pretty happy with the result?
I'm extremely happy with it, Tony, because I think I was very lucky and fortunate to have Kevin cross my path. He did call me out of the blue. I was unfamiliar with his writing and told him so, and said, "Well, I'm not sure at all that, even though, with all due respect, I just don't know you and I don't know your writing style. So I'd be interested to see how you write and what you've written." And he was good enough to send me some copies of some of his works. And I read those and I was duly impressed. And I said, well, it looks like you have never written anything about the air wars. All of your writing has been about the ground troops and what takes place in wartime on the ground. And he said, no, I haven't, but I'm a quick learner, and I would love to explore the subject with you. And I was amazed at the degree of research that he put into his writing for me. And what he didn't mention to you, that just as we reached an agreement as to how we would collaborate, the COVID hit and the pandemic hit. And he said, well, we can't really get together physically, even though we've never met personally, but we can do this over the phone. So that was the manner in which this book was produced, purely by phone interviews almost daily, where he would probe my memory of then 70-odd years to try and pull up and pull back into my recollections some of the things that I went through and how I felt about them at the time. And it was something of a cathartic exercise for me, because I had not spoken about it even to my family for 50 years.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't until I got on the lecture circuit and was invited to address groups, I really became interested in recording and documenting many of the things that historians had missed about the Bloody Hundred Bomb Group. It was an unusual outfit, as the docuseries is now proving. And that's one of the reasons why, Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg chose that to focus on as a microcosm of the Eighth Air Force as it was during World War II, because this was only one of the 39 heavy bomber groups that comprised the Eighth Air Force in 42, to document that. And we're indeed honored and flattered that the 100th was chosen, but interested, of course, in seeing the entire series. We're about halfway through it at this juncture, and I am quite curious about whether or not they have uncovered some of the things that I'm particularly interested in the public knowing about, that were unusual in this group that did not happen to other groups.
What sort of things do you hope Masters of the Air captures that you're looking for in upcoming episodes?
Well, of course, the main thing is accuracy. Reporting and documenting facts and not fiction. The unfortunate part that I have discovered is that oftentimes people who write or who film about the war, who weren't even born then, form opinions and from their research or their understanding of what went on, may or may not have gotten it right. But once it gets published in any form, it's gospel.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to dissuade the public then from knowing what the actual facts might have been. And so I was extremely interested in Tom Hanks public declaration that he wanted this documentary to be the most accurate film he had ever made, or he didn't want his name associated with it. And so with that approach, I felt that that was the right purpose and objective to approach World War II in the air over Europe. And if he followed through with that, and his screenwriters and filmmakers did likewise, that it would be a really an historic depiction of the air war and some of the things that we endured in being part of it. And of course, I'm one of the few who's still remaining that can voice what it was like, and realizing full well that there are a couple of things that film cannot duplicate. And one was the bitter and utter freezing cold that we had to endure in an unpressurized aircraft at high altitude in broad daylight, being shot at for hours on end. You can't really depict that in film. You can show pretty much the chaos and the pandemonium that takes place when you're under attack and in the heat of battle, but you can't really convey how impeding that cold can be at 50 or 60 degrees below zero for hours, and how it impacts your ability to function. And also, another thing that you can't really depict is the sheer terror of being shot at.
The sheer terror part is something that I'd like to talk to you a bit more about. With the scenes in Masters of the Air and what I read in the book that Kevin so masterfully wrote about you. Kevin, I'm not just saying nice things about you because you're on our podcast. I think I read your book, and I have a day job. This isn't all I do. I think I read your book in a day and a half, and it's not like a little tiny book. It's a proper book. It was so well written. Do you think, do I refer to you as John, Mr. Luckadoo, Lucky? What do you prefer?
Lucky.
Lucky.
Damn good. Lucky.
I was hoping you're going to say that. I wanted to call you Lucky so bad. All right. So Lucky, do you think Masters of the Air up to this point, as much as you can in film, has captured some of the confusion and terror and battle that I read Kevin write down your accounts of in his book?
Undoubtedly. It is doing, I think, a very creditable job of giving the public some real semblance of what it was like to be in a heavy bomber in those days. It isn't a pleasant thing to recall, and I haven't appreciated actually having to be to remember it. But Kevin was an excellent interviewer, and he probed my memory and prompted me to really reach deeply inside and try to pull back some of the things I'd tried to push down and forget for so many years, because they were so unpleasant. And that was a closed chapter in my life, and I wanted to forget it, not to remember it. But to recall it and to put it in form that it would be digestible or understandable by, at least to some degree, by the public was quite an exercise and a revelation to me to go through.
So this is for Kevin. You had a chance to interview Lucky and try to get as detailed of an account as you of his memories as you could. I think you've done a great job. What part of his experience did you find particularly compelling that made you say, I need to write a book about this individual?
Lucky and I talked a lot early on about trying to put a human face on this air war. And I think it's something that if you read the reviews of Master of the Air, that they struggle with a little bit, is that connection between the enemy and the characters and the people that are in these airplanes. I think so much of the air war is so, you know, it's a sexy part. The planes are cool looking, but we don't get to the heart of it. And I think what, you know, Lucky and I tried to do from the beginning was put you in the seat with him, give you a chance to experience it. And I think the thing that Lucky and I talked a lot about, and I think that's what gives the reader a chance to really experience it, is the cold. Mm. Getting shot at in the air is feels foreign. It's alien, but we've all been cold, and the amount of the level of cold they endured and the impact it had on them, not only in the aircraft, but afterward and on their bodies, I think is a touch point that I think the reader gets, which is, I think, something we overlook. And it's something I think the Masters of the Air is doing a really good job with, is showing these guys dressed the way they are. You know, it's not Memphis Belle where they're sipping soup and wearing their cool hats, and they don't all look cool, right? They're all dressed. And Lucky and I talked for hours about cold and about how, you know, he's injured, his feet are injured on one mission, you know, and that stays with you. So, you know, to me, I think Lucky does such a good job of bringing this all to life, and having him there to say to him, I think initially some of these questions he thought probably were crazy, but to be able to call him up and say, hey, when this happened to you, what did that smell like? Or what was that like? Or what does that feel like? Or what is the rhythm of the, you know, the controls feel like when you're doing that? You know, to be able to, for him to articulate that was huge. And so that's where I think the power of this book is that Lucky's a gifted storyteller by himself, and that he was able to give me all, like, more than I needed to really put you in the cockpit with him. And that's what makes the book work.
I watched Masters of the Air. I've been listening to the podcast. Lucky was mentioned in last week's episode of the podcast as a resource, as someone who Donald Miller and others reached out to at certain times during production to ask specific questions of. Kevin and Lucky, were both of you a resource for Masters of the Air? Were you able to work with the producers in any way outside of what I heard on the podcast, where they'd give Lucky a call once in a while?
Tony, I was interviewed, I think, a total of 5 times since 2013, 11 years ago, when they began the production. And they told me from the outset that I wasn't going to be in the movie because I was 21 years old then. They were going to have 21-year-old actors impersonate us. And I said, well, I didn't expect to be in the movie, but I just want to be sure that the facts are displayed properly and are revealed. And startling to realize that they hadn't called upon me any more than they did. I thought, well, you know, all things being equal, I'm one of the only few sources.
You were there.
Yeah.
That was actually there and did that and could verify or quantify what it is you're trying to do. And they didn't choose to do that. So that was their choice.
Well, I know on the podcast, they were effusive in their praise for your recollection and how available you were. I mean, did you ever think at this point in your life that there'd be big time movie producers calling you up and there'd be this huge movie series being made about your time in the bomb group? Is this kind of a strange moment for you?
Oh, absolutely. I suddenly realized I was an accidental part of history.
Yeah.
And that what I had experienced was something that was going to be exploited and explored and demonstrated to a degree that the public would be able to access it. Yeah, it's been an exercise in in humility in one respect, and another in sheer interest in making sure as well as I could what the actual facts were and not have them fictionalized. We had some colorful characters, as is being demonstrated in the series, in the group, and they're much more saleable and much more interesting than I was. I was just sticking my nose to the grindstone and doing the job that I had been sent over there to do to the best of my ability, and was really quite a traumatic event when I finally finished my missions and suddenly didn't have a job. Yeah. I was out of work.
Yeah.
And I said, well, for crying out loud, put me to work. Let me fly again. Let me translate my experiences to the replacements that are coming over, because I went over with the original group when it first got to England. And so when I finished up, the war was just less than half over. And I thought that I had a great deal more to contribute than just sitting on the sidelines being put out to pasture. And that's pretty much what they did. And the net result on me was I ended up with PTSD. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it. And neither did they. And I said, it's just sure from sheer inactivity. I've been 4 months since I was in an airplane. And here I've got this experience, and hopefully I could convey it at least in some part to those that are going over and going to face what I did. And I didn't have the benefit of that, but I'd like to make sure that those that come after me do. And they didn't see it that way. So I ended up being sent to the only instrument pilot school in America to learn how to fly instruments. And I said, my God, I needed that before I went to college. Not after.
Yeah, the weather in England is... So I think a couple of things that I've gotten out of books I've read about the 8th Air Force experience, and it's been, you know, obviously captured in Damn Lucky, the book that Kevin has written about your experiences, is it's not just the cold and the sheer terror, but that the weather was as much of as an enemy to these pilots, to you guys, as oftentimes the flak was. Would you agree with that?
Totally. As a matter of fact, as Kevin knows, I said, well, we didn't have one enemy. We had four. Mm-hmm. And they all started with F. And the first one was fear.
Oh.
Because we were scared to death. We didn't have any clue as to what we were confronting with the Luftwaffe. And they'd been fighting for 4 years, so they knew what the heck they were doing. But we didn't. The second was the fighters, of course, and they had the very best equipment. They were the finest air force in the world at that point. And they had been fighting and were battle-tested, and they knew what the heck they were doing. The third was the flak, the anti-aircraft fire that they could defend their targets with and attempt to damage us sufficiently to force us out of the formation, and then they could pick us off at will. And the last but not the least was the freezing. And that was the only physical injury that I sustained in my tour of duty, was frostbitten toes.
How serious was it? And did guys lose toes and fingers? And did they, you know, obviously freeze to death? I mean, I'm sure that happened also, but just kind of curious.
Well, the answer is yes, Ryan. They did. And as a matter of fact, in our hospitals in England, half of the patients were there from frostbite and the other half from battle wounds.
Wow.
But frostbite was a very, very serious factor in our function. And it hasn't been noted or it hasn't been recognized for really what a tremendous deterrent it was and impacted our ability to function.
Hmm. So could you explain to our audience how you got frostbite? What happened on that day?
Well, on a mission to Kassel, K-A-S-S-E-L, deep in Germany one day, a piece of flak penetrated the plexiglass nose of our ship. And it just curiously created this jet of freezing cold air directed right onto my feet. And I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't I couldn't do anything but scream, "For gosh sake, plug that hole." I didn't have anything to plug it up with and couldn't. And I sat there for 5.5 hours with that cold jet stream of air penetrating my boots and my toes. And it literally froze my feet to the rudders, to the pedals. And so when we landed, they had to chip me out.
Jeez. Oh.
And I couldn't stand up, of course. They sent me up to the hospital, and I was there for 8 days. And they packed them in ice first, and then gradually restored them to body temperature. And fortunately, I didn't lose them. But Ryan, you asked about, you didn't hear about fatalities or the injuries that were sustained from frostbite. And they weren't often referred to, but I can tell you that I know at high altitude, in an open window in the waist gun positions, If a gunner would remove his gloves, his fingers could self-amputate to the nearest knuckle. And he wouldn't have any pain. He wouldn't have any blood. He wouldn't have any consciousness of what's happening until he looked on the floor and there were his fingers.
My Lord.
Oh, my gosh. I've never heard it described to that seriousness.
They won't possibly have that in the documentary, I can assure you.
So for
no reference to that whatsoever.
So what kind of temperatures are we talking about up there?
Minus 50 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, my Lord. And the missions, you mentioned being stuck in that position, frozen to the rudder pedals for 5 hours. How long were missions? What kind of range? We're talking 6, 7, 8 hours?
10.
Oh, my
Sometimes
Lord.
10 hours.
And the other thing that you talk about in the book with respect to the cold is you said that it would create kind of a malaise. Like it had this effect on your mental health, your ability to do your job.
Well, the cold we had to endure. And of course, as soon as we landed, we could warm up and we could sleep in a warm bed with clean sheets that night and recover to pretty much a limited degree. But it was just something that we had to contend with, and it was part and parcel of daylight high altitude bombing, which the Brits begged us to abandon. They said, "You can't possibly withstand the losses that you'll sustain from the Luftwaffe by going out in daylight. And for pity's sakes, give it up and join us in nighttime bombing, because we've tried daylight bombing and it isn't successful." The Germans cut them to ribbons, and that's why they resorted to only nighttime bombing at lower altitudes, where they didn't endure the extreme colds that we did. But they were no better protected against what they had to endure than we were.
So there's been more books written about the strategic bombing philosophy, the bomber mafia, about the idea of daylight raids with the Norden bomb site and high precision bombing. And there's been, you look back through the benefit of hindsight, kind of criticized as being maybe not appropriate for the technology of the time. What are your thoughts? What were your thoughts then? I should say you were there about strategic bombing, about daylight bombing. Did you guys believe in that, or were you questioning the efficacy of that strategy at the time?
Neither of the above.
Okay.
We were merely ordered to go out and fly these daylight missions as guinea pigs to prove this strategy was superior to the British. We were totally unaware that the Brits objected strongly to our doing that. As airmen, we didn't have a clue that that kind of debate was going on at the highest levels, all the way up to Prime Minister Churchill and President Roosevelt and Sir Arthur Harris, Bomber Harris, the head of the RAF Bomber Force, said, well, we have attempted daylight bombing and have proven that it is not feasible because the Germans have air superiority over all of Europe. And they control that, and we're playing in their backyard. So we can't possibly overcome that, but we except by nighttime bombing, where they just went over with pathfinders and dropped a flare and bombed on the flare.
And so let's go back in time a little bit. The 100th Bomb Group, I mean, you would arrive there with the leading element of the 100th Bomb Group in June 25th, 1943. But before that, you were being trained as a co-pilot. And you, what I really love about the book, outside of the descriptions of your experiences and the way they take me there, is you have some grievances. instead of hiding them and, you know, and saying, well, you know, that was in the past, you're just like, you know what, this wasn't right. And I want to get this on the record. One of them, could you tell our audience a little bit about being thrown into the cockpit of a plane that you weren't familiar with a crew who didn't know you?
Well, Tony, that was something that I would be very curious to see if there's even any reference to it in the docuseries, because this did not happen in any other group in the 8th Air Force. But upon graduation from flying school, they took 40 of us from my class in Valdosta, Georgia, me included, and immediately sent us to Kearney, Nebraska, to join the 100th Bomb Group, who had already been through pre-combat training for 4 months. We had never been in a B-17 before. Mm. They pulled all of the co-pilots out, gave them new crews, and sent them to other groups, and sent them overseas, and stuck us in the right seat. We didn't have any training as co-pilots. The only training I got before I went to battle was from my pilot.
Mm.
Let me say forthrightly, he was not very forthcoming.
Yeah. Yeah.
He wanted to fly the airplane all the time himself.
Yeah.
And so he was very stingy about what he taught me. And that was stupid,
yeah,
because I was second in command of the crew. If he became incapacitated, I had to take over. Not only fly the ship, but also control the crew. Nine other men. Yep. Their lives were on my shoulders immediately. And so this was totally unfair. And why in the world they chose the 100 Bomb Group to do this, and whether it was just an experiment or whether it was an accident or whether it was intentional doesn't make any difference. But it was so unfair, not only to the individuals, but to the unit, because you were supposed to function as a team. Just like a squad in the infantry any other small group in the military. And we didn't have any opportunity to do that. Also, it created a lot of animosity in some crews, mine included, about somebody who didn't have any experience being suddenly thrust in that position and replacing somebody that they loved.
Yeah.
I mean, that was their best friend. Yeah. The co-pilot was the best friend of the pilot, of the navigator and the bombardier. So they proceeded to make my life hell and try to force me to resign or quit. And Lord knows what they've gotten in my place, but this was their sophomoric way of admitting their dismay at what had taken place. And they did everything in their power to make life uncomfortable for me. And then, I don't know whether you're familiar or not, but when we get to Newfoundland on our way over to combat, the pilot of my crew, we had to await a favorable tailwind or we couldn't make it all the way to Scotland. And so as we were sitting there, he goes over one night across the base and shacks up with a WAF, a British gal who, and ends up with a raging case of VD in the hospital.
Oh my God.
And so our crew, this crew, number 25, had to sit in Newfoundland for 2 weeks waiting for him to be dosed up with sulfa. That's all they had to treat it with then. And then when he's finally released, he'd been bedridden for 2 weeks. He couldn't stand up. We had to load him in the airplane. And he says to me, "Lucky, you're going to have to fly because I can't." And I said, "Well, that's obvious, isn't it?"
Oh, my gosh. And this is after he wouldn't let you have much stick time anyways. And now you have to do it.
So that's the way I got to combat.
There's a couple of two things on this, too. One is if you watch Masters of the Air, the second episode where Egan goes into the pub and he sees somebody hitting on the waitress. And at the end of the, before the end of the episode, he walks by her, he says, "Hey, that guy just has gonorrhea."
Yeah.
That was Di. That was,
that's the guy that you were talking about.
Yep. Holy crap.
So if you read the book, you know the inside story on that. It was a true, he wasn't being mean. He was telling her the truth. Well, the second part of that story is at the 100th Bomb Group reunion in Dallas, when we were doing a Q&A in the book. The night before, I had dinner with Di's grandson, I think, who was all excited about the book. And I'm hoping we can get through this Q&A without Lucky telling that story. That's the one thing, that's the story I don't want him to tell. And we're almost to the last 2 minutes of our Q&A, and Mike Faley, the historian, asks Lucky some way where he can tell that story, and he ends up telling the story. And the whole time, I can't stop looking at his grandson.
Oh, Lucky's telling the story. Okay, so how did his grandson respond to this truthful recollection about his grandfather?
I think it was a known story. Uh-huh. Like, I don't think it was that shocking. We talked a lot about if we wanted to put it in the book, but I will never feel more uncomfortable, Lucky, than that moment when I'm sitting out there and I could feel his eyes on me.
I thought it was refreshing because wars are fought by human beings who are inherently imperfect. And I know we call that, you know, the greatest generation, and I have an enormous amount of reverence, Lucky, for you and your generation and what you did. But it doesn't mean that you guys were angels. I mean, you guys were human beings just like everyone else. You were young men thrust into war. I can't tell you how many times Ryan and I have had an interview, and one of the veterans will start talking about something that happened when he was on leave, and all of a sudden he just kind of, well, let's just say he redirects his conversation to another place. So I thought it was great. To me, it humanizes this. The military is full of snafus. And that was a terrible one for you, where not only did you have to deal with a hostile crew because you replaced one of their crew members who they loved, but they put you in an unfamiliar crew in an unfamiliar aircraft with someone who had some questionable leadership abilities. I thought it was great. It was in the book. I did. Amazing. I love books like this. I love unvarnished, stripped down, gritty books. And that's what Damn Lucky is, written by Kevin Maurer. That's just a small piece of what's in there. And that story about his pilot, Lieutenant Dye, having those issues before they made it over to England is kind of captured in, I think, the second episode of The Masters of the Air, where Captain Egan is letting a girl who's sitting next to Lieutenant Dye at the bar know that maybe she should find somebody else. But at any rate, we're just starting to get into the sort of things that occurred to a newly constituted bomb group in a relatively newly constituted 8th Air Force who was new to this type of warfare and would make a ton of mistakes along the way, and a lot of men would die as well. So join us next week to hear more about the 100th Bomb Group and some of the recollections from Lucky Luckadoo. Well, let's start off this segment of our post-roll by recognizing a couple of our most recent subscribers, Aaron Thompson and Steve Jordell. We really, really, really appreciate you subscribing to our podcast. And for those who may not know, there's two ways that you can do this. One, well, you can go to our website, thewarriornextdoor.com. And one is to, you can go to subscription, which will allow you to subscribe, which you pay as little as $5 a month, which will allow you to get access to all the episodes that we drop without having to wait week after week after week for the episodes to finish. So for example, in this one, Lucky Luckadoo, we'll have 3 or 4 episodes. If you were a premium subscriber, you wouldn't have to wait until next week to listen to the next episode. You'd get them all at once at one time. The second way to support the show is to go to the website again, and on the upper header, there's a button called Donate. And Donate is for a one-time donation, which allows you to give us $1, $2, $20, whatever it is, and it's handled by PayPal. You know, the main thing that the contribution does is it helps us pay for the production costs and the editing and all the things that we need to do to keep this podcast going, this thing that Ryan and I are doing. And speaking of Steve, we got some email from Steve Jordell, which is great. I'd like to share with our audience. He writes, "Hey, Tony and Ryan, just discovered your podcast a couple of months ago and have been binging ever since and enjoying it very much. Love what you're doing. I've been freeloading for a couple of months now. Listened to your Bill Parker obit twice and cried twice." And Ryan did a great job with that. "Ryan, you are a gifted writer, and as someone who strings words together for a living, I would know. I also think keeping these stories alive for future generations is very important. Tonight, I signed up for your premium service, and I added an extra $10 a month, so please choose a couple of young people that you think would keep the mission going and gift them a premium subscription for me," which is absolutely fantastic. And Ryan wrote back to Steve, letting him know how much we appreciate it, and we do. And then Steve responded with this. He's like, "Hey, Ryan, I'm a reporter for the American Family News. It's part of the American Family Radio, a network of about 160 stations and another 160 or so affiliates, mostly in the South. I gave y'all a shout out a couple of weeks ago on one of our talk shows. I hope it got you some listeners, and keep up the good work." Steve, it did. And every time that we have someone like you who finds our podcast and spreads it through word of mouth, we grow. We look at our numbers. We have a chance to see how our podcast is doing. And it continues to do very, very well. And we could not be more honored to have you and other fans listening to the content that we're trying to provide because we're passionate about it. And that's our agenda. That's all we have. So any rate, thank you guys for listening to the podcast. And if you have any comments or any problems with something that that we shared with you, please go to our Facebook page or our website at thewarriornextdoor.com. There's plenty of places where you can add comments, and we'd love to be able to share them with other people on the air. So until next week.